If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, and normally it is my job to analyze my favorite books to help you become a better writer. Today, though, we have a very special interview with Justin Cole, the fantasy author of Master of Sorrows. Justin Cole graduated from Harvard University in 2012 with a master's in literature and creative writing. He has studied fantasy literature for almost two decades and is the author of Master of Sorrows, Book One of the Silent Gods Tetralogy. Justin is also the CEO of Broomstick Monkey Games and co-designer of the games Imperial Harvest, Royal Strawberries, Royal Scum, and Eight Kingdoms. He currently lives in Park City, Utah, with his wife, his two sons, his Great Dane, and his St. Bernard Mastiff. Justin, welcome to the show.
Ahoy, ahoy. It's good to be here.
Thank you for coming. So I want to start on a slightly unconventional note. We will get to the books in a minute, but board games. So,
yeah,
you are already awesome in my books because you are a fantasy author, but the fact that you have designed your own board games has only increased that. So can you just talk us through how you got into designing board games?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I could go the short or the long way, but I tend to be long-winded as a fantasy novelist, so I'll try to keep it short. I kind of fell into a love of board games as a kid, gradually was introduced to things like, obviously, Risk, and other card games. You know, I played Rook with my grandmother growing up. So I've kind of had an eclectic upbringing, but it wasn't until, like, I think my early 20s, like when I was 21, where I was introduced to some more unorthodox board games by some friends and found the board game site, BoardGameGeek.com, which is kind of the nexus for all things board game related. So I just, there was so much information on there, I quickly became enraptured with all things board game, tabletop games, card games, so many games that I'd never played before, and, you know, the narratives that go with those games, the mechanics, and I'm very analytical when it comes to storytelling, but also game play and game design, so I really just wanted to expose myself to a lot of things, kind of an omni-gamer. So I met some friends that introduced me to more games, and I, you know, mostly taught myself a lot of stuff online, but then when I moved to Boston, which was in about 2008, there were a bunch of like-minded young professionals who also had a passion for gaming, and they would get together twice a month and playtest each other's games that they were designing, which was super cool because I had a bunch of ideas, and I didn't really have anybody to play them with often or regularly. So I started bringing games there, and they actually decided to incorporate, I think it was in 2014, and I became the curation director for the Boston Game Makers Guild, and did that for about a year, and then when I moved away, didn't get to participate so much in the game design stuff, but then I launched our first game, Imperial Harvest, in 2015 using Kickstarter. And that did fairly well. And then we had Royal Strawberries and all those other games that you mentioned, which we've developed and designed, but which we haven't published yet because the fantasy stuff started picking up.
Yes.
And so kind of took a break from that. I had three partners at the time, one of which has gone on to do other things, and the other two, which have also gone on to do other things like myself. But we still keep the company alive because we all really like – we just like – developing and designing games. So probably after I finish the Tetralogy, we'll pump out a few more games briefly for a few months, and then I'll go back to designing some, to writing some more fantasy novels. So
it's interesting in my mind, the crossover between designing board games and structuring particularly magic systems in fantasy books.
Oh, for sure.
Because I think that, yeah, having just read the descriptions for, I believe it was Royal Strawberries, it seems to me like perhaps that is where, I don't know what the order is in, but it definitely seems like there's a big crossover in how you use that analytical mindset to structure, you know, game mechanics and then relate that to designing the magic systems and the world for books. How has that sort of played out in your own mind?
Yeah, you know, I've had people talk about Master of Sorrows saying it has some RPG elements like Dungeons and Dragons and characters leveling up, finding a sword plus one, etc. things. And I do agree to a certain extent with those parallels because I played, you know, role-playing games when I was like 14, 15, 16, 17. And I love them, still love them. I just haven't played them in decades and kind of miss them. But when it comes to developing my own games, there's definitely an attraction to a clear set of rules that are easy to teach to people, easy to convey, that are intuitive. I like things, even if there's a lot of things or a lot of complexity, I like it all to be intuitive or elegant. That really appeals to me as a gamer as well as a fantasy novelist. So when I approach either designing a game or writing the magic systems for my books, I follow the same principles. I've got a lot of different magic systems, magic archetypes in my books, but they're all very well defined in my head and on paper. The costs for using the magic, what they can do, all those things are spelled out pretty well so that I can keep myself honest when I'm writing my books, and B, so that it's just aesthetically more pleasing when I tell the story. It resonates more with me, and I think a lot of that comes from being a game designer and having an engineering-oriented mind. My father was an engineer, computer engineer, so definitely some of that rubbed off, even though I don't do much with computers.
So would you say that you kind of, if you, you know, had to choose between the soft magic and the hard magic, would you say that you fall more strongly on that hard magic side of that?
For sure. Definitely a hard magic guy. Brandon Sanderson appeals to me for that very reason, because almost without a doubt, all of his books have a very, generally speaking, especially the adult fantasy books, have a kind of a concrete, hard magic system. When I read soft magic systems in books, I can still enjoy them for sure, but some part of me always questions the depth that the magic can go, why there appear to be limitations for some characters doing magic, but at other times there aren't. And yeah, I'm okay with there being a certain amount of ambiguity while I'm learning the world and its world building and its laws and its rules. But the longer I'm in a world and those ambiguities haven't been resolved, the more frustrated as a reader I become. So I like the puzzle element of saying, okay, I'm not quite sure how it works. There's still a sense of wonder here. That's okay. But that sense of discovery as you progress forward, go, so that's a law. And, well, if that's true, then can they do this? And then later on they do that, and you say, I feel clever for having figured that out ahead of time. What about these other things? And, oh, no, I've overlooked this thing. And, you know, that sort of progression and evolution of learning is fun, and it combines that sense of wonder that you still get from just, you know, magic in general. So I'm a huge fan of hard magic systems, and I doubt I would ever parse myself from that unless I were not heavily invested in a story, which, at least for myself, I'm almost always invested in the story, even if it's a smaller, shorter story.
I totally agree. I think for me, it comes back to Pixar have a maxim that you're allowed to use a coincidence to get your characters into trouble, but you're not allowed to use a coincidence to get them out of trouble. And to me, like, sometimes soft magic can, you know, fall prey to that second use of the coincidence to get the characters out of a tricky situation when, you know, it's not really earned. But yeah, I particularly love, you know, this idea that fantasy books with magic are sort of like a puzzle. They, you know, they unfold, and a lot of the enjoyment and the wonder actually comes from the, like, exposition finally being delivered to you and sort of, like, gradually, you know, the author doling out information about how the magic works, about how the world works and everything. how do you structure that kind of slow release of information in a series that is intended to be 4 books and potentially more in the future? How do you manage to, like, kind of structure that?
That's a fantastic question. It's an interesting one, too, because in Master of Sorrow specifically, I've had lots of people tell me they really like the magic system and tell me it's really unique. And I always, when I hear that, I think, personally, that's interesting you say that, because I put so little of it in book one, me personally, as an author, that I feel like I held back a lot. And I think the readers can feel that. They sense that there's a lot more going on in the world as far as world building and the magic systems are concerned. And they're okay with how much I've given them. I'm not overwhelming them. And they're happy with what I've given them. But I'm always still surprised, because I think, well, if you enjoyed what I gave you, there's a whole lot more coming. In fact, book two, Master Artificer, which I'm almost done drafting right now, nice. Begin revisions on probably in the next week. That one is a lot more oriented towards the protagonist learning about the different forms that magic can take and the different ways that magic can be practiced within the world. So in comparison to book one, there's definitely a lot more there. So, but as far as my philosophy goes, for book one, I think that there's so many things you're trying to establish between world building, character motivations, the protagonist's motivations as a hero or an anti-hero. There's just so much you're trying to build in a fantasy novel specifically. You're recreating an entire world for people, and they're not sure which rules from our world apply in that world. So you kind of have to start at a baseline that feels similar enough to things that they know and have experienced, while still respecting them as a reader who is familiar with certain tropes, so that as they move forward in the story, they have a level of familiarity that's easy to approach, and then you can gradually build on that. And in Master of Sorrows, my goal was to introduce the basic and most important elements and allude to other things so people knew I wasn't just pulling it out of my hat later on, but that I had a plan and that they would know there's a lot more here, but it's not relevant to what's happening right now. So just trust me, hold my hand, and I'll guide you through this first part, this first book. And once we get through it, if you're still interested in the journey and you've enjoyed it, there's going to be a lot more of what you've already experienced, and we'll level up together. That was kind of my philosophy.
You brought up a really interesting point there about starting from a place that is familiar so that you can progress to a place that is a bit strange. Because one of the interesting things with Masters of Sorrows is that on the surface, you could probably claim that it is a very, like, you know, archetypical novel. It's about a young boy who has, like, a prophecy about him. He's going to a magic school. But once you read it, you find that it is actually quite subversive. And particularly, you know, as the book progresses towards the end, it really goes to some different places that you wouldn't expect it to go to if it was just following the tropes. Now,
definitely.
The thing that has always interested me about this approach is that if you kind of start from a place of saying, like, oh yes, it's got all these familiar elements with it, when you reach the end and then you start doing all of the, you know, the postmodern stuff where it's like, oh, you're actually in a simulation instead, or, like, you know, there's actually aliens or something, there can be a bit of reader, you know, dissonance. So, and I don't think, for the record, that was a thing with Masters of Sorrow. So I just want to know how you did that. Like, how did you manage to balance between, you know, the familiarity and the strange?
You know, that's a fantastic question. I'm glad you brought it up, because that's something that really concerned me as an author. And I kind of figured there's other ways to approach this, but I figure there's two ways to go about it. You either start with the familiar and kind of gradually introduce the other stuff, and some readers will fall away from the story. They will say, this isn't what I expected. This isn't the same story that we started out with. So I'm disappointed. I'm going to give it a thumbs down. And other readers will love that journey. And you're kind of taking a risk, regardless when you start out with a certain archetypal story and then subvert that story. And you can do it that way, but another way is to tell people from the start, I'm going to tell you a story that feels familiar, but I'm also going to subvert it. And you just tell them flat out, this is my plan. I'm telling you right now so that you know it's not a surprise. You're not going to be blindsided. You're going to expect me to subvert things, but I'm still going to subvert things in a way that will be surprising. And if you tell them that, my feeling was you were a lot less likely to lose readers because they knew what they were getting into before they started. And I think that's held true for the majority of readers. But it's also sort of backfired because part of the marketing pitch for the series is the hero is, may or may not be the reincarnation of the Dark Lord for the series. He's this he is this evil villain, essentially, is what you're telling the readers. But you read the first book and you're like, I don't know that he is. I don't know that I got that. There's allusions to that, but I didn't, you know, we didn't end book one with like, now this is the Dark Lord who will take over the world. And this is fantastic. And none of that is in book one. So if there's a reader that's going in with that expectation, I've had some readers that were disappointed. And rightfully so, because as far as marketing that series, that's hard to do. You're going to have some people with a certain expectation, and they'll get in there and say, well, I didn't get what I wanted in book one. I don't think I'm going to keep going. But most readers, they say, you know what? The writing's good. It feels familiar. I'm just going to go with it. And then they get through the end of the book and they say, this was surprising yet inevitable. It was satisfying. It feels different, but also the same. It's classic yet modern. It's nostalgic yet unique. It's kind of this weird niche that makes everybody happy and yet is a little bit different. Maybe not everybody, but you get what I mean.
Really interesting. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
In addition to being a fantasy author and a board game designer, you also appear to be a psychic, because that's pretty much describing my own reaction to the book. I read it, I really enjoyed it, but, you know, part of me was like, I was sort of expecting him to be doing, like, more evil stuff throughout the book. And then The more I thought about it, and I actually read your own Goodreads review of your own book, which are always great to read. I particularly love Patrick Rothfuss's review of book three, hasn't come out. But
I wrote my review immediately after rereading his own review of book three.
No way!
That's what inspired me to write my review of the book.
Great. Well, I have also left a review of my own book, so there we go. We are all following from the same tradition. But One of the interesting things that you pointed out is effectively what you just described then, this idea that the marketing pitch doesn't necessarily align with what exactly happens in the first book. But then you pointed out something else, and I realized that this was actually genius, which was that, sure, the story might be as a whole about a young boy becoming evil, but like, he's not going to say that he's becoming evil. He's not going to be aware that what he's doing is necessarily evil, because everyone is, to some extent, the hero of their own story. And it made me realize that, oh yeah, of course, that's why I didn't pick up, you know, any like obviously evil actions that he did, because if it was obviously evil, then you probably wouldn't be telling a very nuanced and morally ambiguous tale, which is what I feel the intention is.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think like congratulations on striking that balance. Definitely going to be a hard one, but it worked.
It is, and that's why I think that because it's so risky, I'll be frank, I don't think any author has attempted to be as nuanced when they approach it, because they run the exact risk that I just voiced earlier, which is some people are going to expect a lot more darkness in that first novel, and if they do, you're not going to get that sense of, I'll put it this way. By the time people get to the end of the tetralogy, I want to have brought them to the point where they're reading a book that one person would argue, this is definitely a Dark Lord. The protagonist is the Dark Lord. He meets all the tropes. He's done all these things, and they would say he's evil. And then somebody else would say, you know, I agree that many of the tropes were met, but I don't think he's evil. I think he's good. And if most or all of the readers agree with one side of that argument, I think I've failed. But if there are a lot of people arguing about it. They've enjoyed the book, but one half says he's bad, one half says he's good, and they debate that. Or maybe there's a lot of people who fall in the middle, but they are all supportive of who he is as a character, then I think I've succeeded. So if I can reach the point where you get into the series and you know, you've had this heroic or anti-heroic journey, however you want to describe it, and it's different from all the other ones because he's not the traditional archetypal hero, even though he started that way, and it was still a satisfying journey, but you didn't end up disliking the character by the end. So regardless of whether his actions were amoral or immoral or justifiable, regardless, if you still support him and feel like, you know, if I had been in his position, I might have done the same thing, I probably would have done the same thing, then I think I've succeeded as an author. So that's my goal. But getting there in four books without screwing it up is going to be the trick.
That will be the interesting part for sure.
Yeah. I think for book one, I had it a little bit easier because you can basically say, don't go too dark too quick or else you won't have anywhere to go. But you definitely need to allude to all the places you're planning on going and leave enough ambiguity that people will have an idea of where the story is going to go. But at the same time, he should still mostly be a reluctant hero. And I think that's accomplished in book one. And I think I've definitely taken him farther along his arc in book two in the direction I'm planning on going in a satisfying way. So I think so far everything is going according to plan. We'll see how well it goes for all four books.
Speaking of plans, have you got the entire series outlined in some detail?
Yeah, I've got 12 books outlined.
12 books? Interesting. So what's the... I mean, obviously, yeah, you don't want to give away too much, so you feel free to evade this question if you want, but, like, where do you plan on taking it after the first four books, which is the tetralogy that you're working on right now?
Yeah, you know, I don't mind spoiling this because, A, I've sort of already spoiled... the hero is essentially the Dark Lord for the series.
I mean, it's on the first line of the blurb, so people should be aware.
And the thing is, because it's so blatant, a lot of people are like, oh, well, he's probably just subverting that. He's still going to be a hero by the end of the series. And a lot of people assume that. And others are like, no, he'll be the Dark Lord, but I'm trying to hit somewhere in between. So no matter what your expectation is based on marketing, there are going to be surprises along the way that people won't expect. So having said that, my goal for the first four books is to get the hero from, you know, traditional archetypal hero, and by the end of the series to essentially the Dark Lord that fulfills all those tropes. But I have in my head, you know, once you've done all the work of creating this fantastic four-book origin story, you still have all of the potential of, well, now we have a Dark Lord character who is a very resonant protagonist that, you know, you probably understand better than any other Dark Lord in any other series currently written, simply because no other series has written it from that exact character's perspective. So why not play with that a little more with the tropes? So in my mind, assuming that, you know, the first four books do well, then we can keep going and do another arc for the hero wherein he's the Dark Lord. But now we have the roles are reversed. Now there is a prophesied hero who is supposed to defeat him, and how does he handle that? As this sympathetic Dark Lord character is like, well, what tropes do you follow as the Dark Lord? Are you going to go try and hunt down that hero who's supposed to defeat you and kill him? Or are you going to allow him to defeat you? He's causing a lot of problems, etc. So that's kind of the direction I see the second tetralogy being. And the third tetralogy, because it's so far out, all I'll say is it has things that I've laid the foundation for in book one of Master of Sorrows.
Interesting.
But it's essentially a rogues gallery where we can reunite characters from the first eight books, and they would all be together kind of going on a unique quest. But I won't say more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so far in the future, but that sounds like a great plan, and I'm, yeah, very excited to see how it goes in the future.
So, I'm super excited about it, but it's so far out there, I'm like, I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Yeah, absolutely, and also I find that, like, for me personally, the more I talk about future things that I want to write, sometimes it can decrease my motivation to write them, because I'm like, oh, I've sort of got like, you know, they thought this was a good idea and they seemed to be entertained by it. And like, I don't know, for whatever reason, that seems to decrease my own motivation to write it because it feels like it's already been written. I don't know if you feel that as well.
When I was younger, I did. The more writing I've done, it's kind of done the opposite. The more I talk about it, the more excited I get about it.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'll see if that happens with me as well. So, moving into the past, here, we've talked a lot about the future. Yeah. You put out a tweet a few days ago saying that in 2010, you were a staff assistant at Harvard who had just started night classes and was working on your thesis, and then now, in 2020, you have a Harvard degree, and your thesis has become a wonderful fantasy novel, and you've got the second book coming soon. So, just rolling back a bit to 2010, can you describe to me what it was like to be a staff assistant at Harvard, you know, doing night classes, working on your thesis? I'm very fascinated by, you know, the idea of, like, working on a fantasy novel within a university setting, because it's not something that I think many people have experienced. So could you perhaps talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's definitely atypical, I think. And maybe it's atypical because it's not a good way to go about doing it. The reason I say that is because, you know, writing Master of Sorrows, I think all told, between first conceptualization of initial mythology and ideas to, like, getting the book published, I think it's been like 17 years.
Wow.
And there's very few people that can just talk about a book like that unless they, A, haven't published the book, or they're J.R.R. Tolkien.
He had to invent a language, so.
Right, and I don't want to be in the former category, and I don't consider myself to be in the latter category. So, having said that, though, you know, I'd spent off and on years writing on chapters for my book, never being quite satisfied with the quality of the chapters, always going back to rewrite. And when I knew I was going to become a fantasy author at some point, I didn't really have a doubt about that. It was just a question of when I felt I was personally ready. And I think I'm a lot harder on myself than I don't know, in comparison to most other authors. I think all authors are hard on themselves. But I certainly didn't want to go out there and fail. So I probably took longer than I needed to before I sent my book out into the world. But one of the ways I went about getting it written was the thesis. So I probably had 200 or 300 pages written before I applied for my thesis at Harvard. And I'd deliberately attempted to get a degree in literature and creative writing so that, A, I could make my books better and my writing better, and B, so that when I did my thesis, I could, you know, it was the only thesis where I could do a creative project for the thesis. And usually it was like, I think they asked for like a 10-page paper explaining the content of the creative work, and then it had to be like 80 or 90 pages in length. And I looked at that and said, well, I could just get away with just doing the bare minimum, but I'm doing this as a goal to finish a fantasy novel, so I'm going to write the darn fantasy novel. So I gave them the outline for what I thought was just one book, and they accepted the proposal the first time, which was my thesis director told me, I think the sixth time in the history of the program that had happened, which made
me... Whoa, congrats. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, so as I said, like, I took a long time to think it all out, and I covered all my bases, and they were super excited about it. I sat down to write it, and it turned out that Master of Sorrows was just the first third of my outline. So that's when I realized, well, I maybe have outlined too much content. I need to stop adding to my outlines. I need to start writing books. So that's when I very slowly started looking for agents, but I was also still working and starting a family, and so I didn't pursue anything with too much vigor, just because I was like, you know, the time will come when I'm ready and when the time is ready. And it took a couple years, but I think I only submitted to maybe 12 or 15 agents before I had somebody offer to rep me, and then that was it.
Wow, that's quite rare to only have to submit to such a small pool. Why do you think that was?
I think it's a combination of Well, I'll say the book is good. I believe that. I genuinely believe Master of Sorrows is a good book. The first 80 pages of the first draft of that book was not very palatable. It was like drinking water from a fire hose when it comes to world building. There was just like a lot of stuff I just threw at them, and I was like, if you can handle it, then you'll enjoy what's coming. If you can't, well, that's, you don't have to read any further. And maybe I was a little too blunt about that. But I was kind of writing a book that I wanted to write that resonated with me and all the books I'd read before and the writers and influences I'd had. And sending it out to people, I always felt bad because I knew the first 30 pages were not going to be they were good writing, but they wouldn't be representative of the story because I had like three prologues, you know, which they tell you don't have any prologues. So you look at that and I say, well, I wasn't going to cut it out because I felt these were important. They were important to me. They were important to the story. So I was just going to see what worked. And so the writing itself in general was good, maybe not for that first section. But I think beyond that, I just researched the right people. I didn't just submit to anybody, and I wasn't willing to just accept anyone. So I sent it out to maybe two or three agents at a time, and then I would wait 2 or 3 months, which is probably more than I need to, and then I'd send it out to one or two more, and I just kind of kept a slow process going, and I made sure the people I sent it to, I always modified my queries just a tiny bit, making sure it was personalized to them, and I was very thoughtful about everything. I curated everything very carefully. So I think other people, if they're approaching that process, maybe they're going to a lot of conventions and they already know people, so they have an in. I didn't have an in. I didn't even know I should be going to conventions to talk to agents or anything like that. So I just was going through the standard process, and something ended up clicking with the agent who ended up picking me up, who was actually my number one choice, and who then left the business later. And I ended up with my international agent, Danny Bear, who is just a rock star among agents. And he represents me domestically as well as internationally now. So that ended up working out too. So I've been really happy with the whole process, even though it's been very unorthodox.
What are some of the lessons that you've learned from your time in the publishing industry, whether that's from your agent, your editor, or just being part of the general process? Was there anything that was particularly unexpected or, I guess, revelatory that you've learned through publishing this book and working on subsequent ones? That sounds like a yes.
No. I think I could probably think of a dozen things, but the one that jumps to my mind first is I mentioned before that my own process as a writer has essentially been, and you can see it with all the anecdotes I've already told you, I like to take my time doing something right, maybe more time than I need to. And that can end up working out well, except, you know, for a lot of people, they probably shouldn't take that so much time. They should probably just push forward and cross their fingers and make mistakes, and they'll learn quicker from those mistakes than they can from their successes. And I think getting my book published was a great example of that, because I had a good book for my first draft anyway, but I didn't really revise it too much before sending it out to people, because I'd spent so long writing it. I think it was good to go already when I finally did finish it. And when the publishers got a hold of it, we did structural edits, we did line edits, we did proofs, and just all of the different pieces. There's probably like five different editors that are involved in the process, and three different major levels of revisions that most authors go through. And realizing that after the fact kind of told me, oh, I don't have to be perfect to succeed. I can just like tell the story that I want to tell as best as I can, as quickly as I can, ideally. And I've got all these allies who are there to tell me when I'm screwing up, tell me when I'm off track, tell me when I could use a better turn of the phrase. Because essentially, if you've gotten that far and they're buying your book, you probably already have the skills necessary to write a good book, and these people are there to make a good book better. Whereas I was going in saying, I need to write the best book, and then if they can help me, great. but I need to be the best going in. And I think you should still shoot for that. But I think there's also a certain amount of allowances for not being perfect when you write, because if you focus so much on trying to be perfect, there are all these other people whose job it is to help you be the best, be better, and you're not letting job. You're taking longer doing your job and depriving them of their opportunity to help you. So if you trust them and they trust you, you can actually be more productive and better. And that was a new revelation for me. I hadn't realized you could have so many allies who were so helpful. So
I've tried to be a lot
less hands-on with, a lot less OCD maybe when it comes to writing books.
So on that note, like, how has your process in terms of your writing process, how has that changed, if at all, compared to, you know, pre-publication versus post-publication, working on Master Artificer and such on?
Yeah, no, that's a great follow-up question. So I think I'm an outliner. I'm very analytical, as I already mentioned before, and so it's very difficult for me to separate myself from plotting things and having all the bullet points mapped out and following the arcs as intended. And I've studied a lot of storytelling, both in writing books as well as writing screenplays, and I kind of merge those two elements when I write, and I take the tools that I need and apply them to whatever work I'm working on. But I think I've done a lot more outlining in the past, and I still do a ton of outlining. I probably can never get away from that as an author. But the more I write, the more I've recognized a lot of the discovery writing that I do, especially with minor characters, ends up becoming some of my favorite stuff, which tells me I probably don't need to lean so heavily on the crutch of mapping everything out before I go. I can probably trust my instincts, and the writing will probably be better, and it will take a lot less time to do it. So I definitely spent way more time on book one, and still a fair amount of time on book two, longer than I would have liked, but far less time than book one. And I'm hoping as I continue, I'm going to cut down those times even shorter, because I'm moving away from outlining so much and moving more towards discovery writing. And I'll probably end up being more of a hybrid writer anyway. But definitely just kind of relying more on my intuition and knowing that I'm confident in where the story is going because I already know. And so I can kind of have fun along the way without mapping it all out and spelling out every little line and every little detail, even though sometimes that gives me a lot of pleasure too. So, that's been an evolution for me.
It's a really interesting transition for sure. And I guess it comes down to that whole, you know, internalizing the art of structuring stories and crafting character arcs and everything until it reaches a stage where you don't really have to think about it anymore. And it's just, you know, an unconscious action. Are there any particular, because you mentioned that you have also written some screenplays. Are there any particular writing craft books, writing advice books, or resources that you have found particularly useful? I know you've mentioned the Writing Excuses podcast, which is one of my favorite as well. What are some other good resources you would recommend?
Yeah, I adore the Writing Excuses podcast. So I'll say, though, I'll caveat anything I say with the comment that whatever tool you use, you shouldn't rely entirely on it. And some tools will work for you and some won't. So just throwing a couple books out there that I found really helpful, but which I don't really rely on too heavily either. They've just been kind of informative. They're another tool for the toolbox.
Yes.
I would say there's Blake Snyder's Save the Cat, which is a good book for talking about structure and screenwriting and kind of spacing your beats out and finding the right rhythm for the arcs, the traditional story arc. There's a lot of hero's journey books that I've read. So Blake Snyder's Save the Cat is one version of the hero's journey. Christopher Vogler has a book called The Writer's Journey, which I actually like even better. It's one of my favorites when it comes to story structure. And that one borrows very heavily from Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell, and The Hero with a Thousand Faces. All of these monomyth type books that talk about the hero's journey and the different steps. And there might be 17 steps or 12 steps or 15 steps, depending on who's telling it and what they're summarizing and what they're including. And some may say it has to be in this order, or you can rearrange the steps as you will. But I do agree that, generally speaking, even if you're not intentionally following a heroic arc, I think it's almost impossible to divorce yourself from that that formula. And so I think good stories just kind of inherently have a resonance to them that is similar to all good stories. So if you've internalized that and aren't spelling out every single step, but just kind of feel the natural rhythm of the story and which direction it needs to go, and when things need to go wrong and when they need to go well, and you can kind of feel those beats out, I think you'll naturally lean towards those beats, even if you're not a huge proponent of the hero's journey. I think that any writer will end up having those steps there. But that's also because I'm kind of a student of the hero's journey, so I've read a lot of books on it. Beyond that, definitely the Writer's Excuses podcast, because there's a variety of writers there who have varying perspectives. And I think the more you read and the more perspectives you get, the more informed you're going to be and the better you're going to be able to identify your own voice, your own tools, the things that work well for you. Even the, 101 Habits of Highly Effective Screenwriters, 101 Habits of Highly Effective Novelists. I've read both of those books, and one of the best things about them was seeing the variety of people's approaches to doing writing and storytelling. Because you'd get some really different perspectives on, oh, I need to write in the morning, I need to write in the evening, I need to outline, I need to discover, right? So many different things. And one of the best lessons I learned was there's no wrong way to do it. You just need to find the way that works for you. And even if you find a way that works for you, you're going to change as a writer. And every book you write will almost inevitably have a different process. And you need to accept that. Maybe there's a different tool you use physically. Maybe you prefer to write on a typewriter for a couple months. Then you switch back to your laptop or your iPad or a handwritten journal. Maybe there's a different structural, theoretical approach. But whatever it is, don't fight it. Find your voice. Find what works. But don't spend forever looking for different approaches either. Just find what resonates for you as an author. And the better you get at defining your voice and being aware of your voice, I think the less searching you have to do. And you'll just be familiar enough with your toolkit that you can go in and write any story and solve any creative writing problem.
On the topic of awareness as a writer, what would you say, and we've touched upon this a little bit, but what would you say is your biggest strength as a writer and your biggest weakness?
I only have to pick one of each. Interesting.
You can throw out a couple if you want. And then...
it's probably easier to throw out a couple because then I don't have to be so precise in my in my word choice. I'm an analytical person, as I mentioned before. That can be a strength and a weakness. And I think if I was being very concise, that would be my answer, because being analytical makes it easy to outline books prior to drafting, but it also makes the drafting process hard because that's more creative and you kind of have to trust your gut and go with it rather than connecting the dots. And I can do both, but because I'm so analytical, a lot of times it's easier to fall into that outlining process or even the revision process, because you already have something in front of you. You have something you can work with. You can see the flaws and the errors, so you know what you need to fix. And I'm confident enough as an author and as an artist that I can spot the problems, and I feel any problem I spot, I'll find a way to fix it. That's not my worry. My worry is being happy with what I have at the end and getting to that point, and frankly just drafting it because I get paralyzed by the notion that I'm creating something that's imperfect. That's very hard for me. Having said that, I'll also say that my screenwriting background has given me a lot more confidence when it comes to things like writing normal feeling dialogue and action scenes, fight scenes, and also the magic systems that my experience with game design, world building in general. So those things, world building, action, dialogue, magic systems, those are things that feel comfortable to me, and I don't get anxious about what I'm doing. I don't overthink it. I just kind of go into it, and I'm excited, and I have fun. But when it comes to, like, internal monologues and describing a setting or a scene or thinking back on something, things that you can't see in a movie, those are things that I haven't practiced quite as much because they don't overlap with screenwriting or game design. And because I'm less experienced with them, in part, they're less enjoyable, and in part, I'm just not confident enough with them. So I'll often spend, ironically, more time doing those pieces than I probably need to, because I'm just not sure that I've achieved what I want to achieve. And then I'll write maybe three times as much as I should, and then I'll go back and cut out, you know, the other two-thirds that I shouldn't have included in the first place. So I think that's probably my weakness as an author, and as I get farther along in the process, I think I'll kind of unite those strengths and weaknesses to where I just kind of sail along. Hopefully. That's what we all hope for, right?
Yes. Well, it definitely seems to me that, yeah, you have evolved even in terms of the whole going from a place of requiring a lot of outlining to a place of feeling confident in your ability to discovery write and everything. So on that note of, like, confidence, it seems like you, and you have the skill to back up that confidence, I should add, but, like, it seems that you've always been aware that you are going to become a fantasy author and that it's always going to be a thing that is on your horizon and is now, I guess, like, in your horizon. I didn't even know what the opposite of that word is. But was there a time when you felt like giving up on writing, or was there a time when it felt particularly difficult to do? And if so, how did you get through that struggle?
You know, anytime I write a first draft, it feels difficult. 'Cause you're taking something that seems perfect in your head, this perfect outline, whether it took me 2 days or 2 years to write, and you're putting it on the page and you're looking at the words and saying, this isn't perfect. What I had in my mind was perfect, and this is less than perfect. Sometimes it's actually really crappy. And that can be very disheartening, disillusioning, depressing, other D words. It can be very hard as an author, especially when you're writing in a void and no one's told you you're any good. You don't show your stuff to other people because you don't want people to see your flaws. I think the authors that are blessed with the confidence and ability to share their stuff with people from an early stage in their career, I don't know if that's better or worse, because you can also fall into the pit of constantly listening to other people's opinions and constantly revising your stuff and not ever trusting your own voice. But for myself, I trusted myself and my voice. I knew that what I was doing was good, but I didn't want other people to see that it wasn't perfect. So I always struggle with that in my first drafts, getting to the point where I say, this is good enough to show to my editor. This is good enough to show to an alpha reader or a beta reader. And that can be paralyzing in getting a story told. And it's always been that way for me. And I hope it won't be that way in the future as I continue and to evolve as a writer. But hearing things like my editor, she told me, you know, this first draft of the book that the Master Artificer I was sending her said, this is leveled up. This is better than the drafts that I had of Master of Sorrows, and this is better than most of the first drafts that I get from my very established authors. And I thought, oh, that means I'm probably overthinking myself and having a lack of confidence. I should probably just trust that I know what I'm doing and that other people will correct me if I'm wrong, and I should probably just move forward. And I keep getting that feedback. And so as an author, that's definitely been the hardest. But most especially before getting published, because when that's happening, nobody's there to tell you, to give you a 5-star rating on Goodreads or Amazon. Nobody's there to tell you, I really enjoyed the book. It helped me through a hard time. Nobody's there to say, I finished reading it and it makes sense and I love it. All they're getting especially if you're writing in an academic setting, as I often was, they're getting a chapter or two and they're looking at all the flaws in that chapter and they can't connect it to any of the other story. So you have to be able to figure out which comments apply to you and your story and which don't, because they don't know enough about it. And that, maybe figuring that out on my own, helped me develop confidence as an author. Probably also made me a little arrogant. But I think being an author, being a successful author, you have to be a certain amount of arrogant to be able to do something that's very difficult and to trust your gut. But you also have to be a certain amount of insecure so that you're never happy with what you've written and you're willing to accept feedback from other people who are experienced. And finding that balance, I mean, that's probably why writers are so neurotic, because it's a strange dichotomy that's hard to have. But I think that would be the hardest thing for me. Beyond that, I've always had the confidence that I was a good writer from forever. In my life, I've always been told that by other people. But it's one thing to be the best writer in your elementary school or in your high school or in your creative writing class, and it's another thing to be another writer in a field of many successful, amazing, published authors, especially authors writing in your genre. And suddenly you're like, you know, I'm a small fish in a big pond right now, and this is hard. This is intimidating. So both parts of that process are hard.
It's really interesting, something that you just said during that, because you mentioned how, as a writer, you need to kind of strike a balance between having the arrogance that to think that other people would want to read the things that you just dreamed up one day, tempered by the humility that you aren't perfect and that you need to improve your writing, you need to improve your craft, and you need to work at it, you know, every day. Another author I interviewed, Gabriel Bergmoser, he mentioned literally the same thing. I asked him, what was the thing most critical to your success? And he said, delusion. Like the delusion to think that my writing was actually worthwhile, tempered by the, you know, humility to realize that it wasn't very good yet. But like, if you go too far in either of those directions, you're probably never going to succeed at it. You have to have a certain level of confidence and self-belief, but you also have to have the humility to realize that you're probably going to have to work at it for, in your case, you know, 17 years before anything good really comes of it. So thank you for sharing that. That was really great.
Yeah.
So a couple of rapid fire questions before we finish up. What has been your favorite book that you read this year?
Oh, I've read so many. I'll preface by saying I mostly listen to audiobooks, because if I'm not, if I have the time to read a book that's a hard copy, then I will usually be writing instead. Having said that, I've read a lot of books that are the end of a series that were good. So just throwing some out rather than spinning my wheels and just throw a couple out.
Go for it.
Ed McDonald's Crowfall, I really enjoyed. That was the final book to his Ravenmark trilogy. Mark Lawrence had the first book of The Ancestor, which I really enjoyed. I thought the first book was the strongest of the series, but I enjoyed the entire trilogy. Pretty much anything Brandon Sanderson writes turns to gold. And that's
absolutely
always,
I love it.
Amazing and inspiring and also disheartening, because you're like, he writes so much so fast and it's so good, you're like, there has to be a trade-off.
Well, sorry to interrupt you there, but I just have to say this. Like, we both retweeted the same tweet by him the other day, which was when he wrote 19,000 words in one day over New Year's on the fourth Stormlight archive book. And I feel like we're probably both in the same camp of like, this is great that we get to read like this guy and that he is alive and producing such amazing work. But at the same time, we're also like, ah, that's a high bar.
It is. And knowing that you don't have to reach that bar is good, but also like, everybody wants to reach that bar. And you're like, I don't think I can. That's like a freaking, that's like, it's genius level. Like, what is the word? Savant. He's like savant level.
Mm.
And you're just like, this is incredible. I don't know. Are you a team of writers that, like, how do you manage to produce so much that is so consistently good? And he has, like, a certain voice that's consistent, so people know what they're getting. And I can tell people, like one thing when I read Sanderson, consistently, always, the very first couple chapters of his books are always a little bit hard to get into because he just kind of throws his world building at you.
Yes.
But you always know the payoff, the final couple chapters, he's going to have this giant twist that you weren't expecting, but you were expecting, but it was surprising, yet inevitable and satisfying, and you're going, every time he can do that and still write in a style that is approachable and enjoyable, and the characters and the story are fun, and being able to do that every time and so often and so much, like, it's daunting, it's amazing, it's inspiring, it's threatening, it's all of those things. And I just he's a great role model for all of those reasons, I think, and probably one of the reasons why he's my favorite authors. So maybe I can't say my favorite book that I've read this past year, because there have been a lot of great ones, but definitely my favorite author is Brandon Sanderson.
What is the best writing advice that you have ever received?
That's a difficult one because, as I mentioned already, I don't think any specific piece of writing advice is always the best piece of writing advice. And maybe that's the best advice I've ever gotten, even though I've gotten it from multiple people, and it's a lesson I've had to learn multiple times. But finding what works for you and not being afraid to adapt, and, you know, learning from everything you can. Learn from everything, but don't accept anything as a single gospel truth. What works for one person may or may not work for you. And I think recognizing that is going to help every writer become a better writer.
All right, last question before we finish this interview up. So Master Artificer is the next book coming out in the Silent Gods tetralogy. That's a hard word to say, tetralogy. Is it about? Can you give us a quick pitch about the book?
I can't.
You can't?
I can't.
You cannot? No, are you still working on it?
I can.
Oh, sorry. I thought you heard. I heard can't for some reason. And I was like, okay, I will swiftly move on. No, all good. Okay, continue.
Yeah, so let's see. If Master of Sorrows is about a hero at a university, a young teen, well, at a university, an academy, learning about how to steal magic artifacts. And, you know, I don't want to summarize too much of the book because it's coming out, and because that's not the question you asked me about. But you kind of have to know a little bit about Master of Sorrows from the setup for book two. So I'll say that at the conclusion of Master of Sorrows, things have sufficiently changed for the hero that he's surrounded by a group of allies, and they're headed to the capital city of Lucura. And he's kind of going on a quest for a couple of things. One is he has this cursed item with him that he's trying to get rid of. And that's a huge part of the book, him trying to find a way to get rid of that item. And he's also searching for the people who were behind the attacks against him and his friends in book one. And that sort of discovering who can help me get rid of this thing, who are my enemies, who are my allies, what are their motives, that's a huge part of book two, as well as that discovery of how does magic really work for other people? Because I've been in this village for so long, my perspective of the world has been limited by the people that I've been surrounded by and the village that I was in. And now I'm seeing a larger world and a larger perspective of both culture, tradition, magic, and all of those have an impact on the character. So having said that, I would say that the short pitch would be the protagonist continues his heroic journey surrounded by allies and quests for knowledge and salvation, and in the process takes a dark evolution in his own heroic journey.
Sounds awesome. I'm very excited for that. And when can we roughly expect that to come out?
Let's see. I would expect, so Master of Sorrows came out February 25th, 2019, in the UK and the rest of the world in English. And it's coming out in the US it came out February 21st in the UK. It's coming out February 25th of 2020 in the US. And we're trying to actually get those to line up a bit better. So I would expect that, based on what I've heard from my publisher, the UK publisher is probably going to delay Master Artificer so that it lines up with the US publication date. So this year, US folks are getting Master of Sorrows. And unfortunately, I think people in the UK and Australia and other parts of the world are probably going to have to wait until 2021 to get Master Artificer. It may be earlier, but it's looking like that's the case. I finished Master Artificer, more or less. I've got just a couple chapters left to write, which I was hoping to finish around the same time Brandon was finishing his book.
Ah, that would have been great.
It would have been. And then I got sick, and I stayed up all night with a fever, so it was rough. But Master Artificer is longer than Master of Sorrows. It's like 800 pages right now, and we've got revisions to do and edits, and so that'll take a couple months. Probably by the time we're done, they're going to throw it into the same slot that the U.S. date has. So I would expect February of 2021, everyone worldwide will get to see Master Artificer. And otherwise, it's just Master of Sorrows for the folks in the U.S. this year.
Great. Well, either way, I'm very excited for that. Justin, thank you so much for this chat. I really enjoyed this and definitely think you've given me a lot of good insights into writing. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jed.
Thank you for listening to the Novel Analyst Podcast. I had a blast interviewing Justin. I always enjoy talking to fellow creatives. And if you enjoyed my conversation with a fellow writer, you may be interested in my other podcast, Half-Baked Stories. On every episode of Half-Baked Stories, we take three writers, one of whom is myself, and we lock ourselves in a room for 30 minutes, each coming with one storytelling idea, which we then have 30 minutes to combine into a single story. So for one episode, our storytelling ingredients might be a bouncy castle, a revenge thriller, and Tom Cruise. And then somehow we have to combine those into a single narrative that somehow works together. So it's a lot of fun. We've produced 10 episodes so far, which you can listen to right now for free. Just go to Half-Baked Stories. Should be available in all podcast feeds, and I will put a link in the show notes as well. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.